Hey, it's Callie, and you're listening to the 48th episode of the Hippie Haven podcast. If you're new here, I release an episode every Wednesday related to living an ethical and eco-friendly lifestyle. We cover all sorts of topics, like how to make less trash, composting, urban beekeeping, secondhand shopping, starting an eco-friendly business, and much more. My goal is to inspire you to take action, both in your day-to-day routine and on a larger scale of community activism, because I do believe that together we will make a difference. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe so you automatically get each new episode right when it comes out. Today's guest is LaVie, a psychotherapist and host of the Thrift Therapy podcast. We're talking about thrifting as a lifestyle, her best thrifting tips, the psychology behind shopping and why it makes us feel so good, how to avoid unnecessary impulse purchases, how to help yourself or a loved one from relying too much on retail therapy, and why some people become hoarders. As always, you can find the show notes and transcript for this episode on my website, hippiehavenpodcast.com/048. Today's episode is brought to you by the Lemonade Boutique, a women's clothing with a cause store. Every item is ethically made by women overcoming extreme challenges, such as sex trafficking, abuse, addiction, and more. At the Lemonade Boutique, you can help these women take life's lemons and make lemonade. Shop online at www.thelemonadeboutique.com, and listeners of the Hippie Haven podcast can save 10% off your order by using the code HHP at checkout. As always, thank you for supporting our partners and helping us keep the mic on. Reminder to my listeners in the Southern California area that I'm currently doing several events down here in this region. Tomorrow, Thursday, August 15th, I am participating in a discussion on how to make a difference in your community at the Refill Shop in Ventura, California. Saturday, August 17th, I'm doing a DIY bath salt recipe workshop at Bring Your Own in Long Beach, California. On August 21st, I'm doing a no-sew t-shirt tote bag workshop at Sonora Refillery in Oceanside, California, and several more in the following weeks. So if you want to get event details, make sure to check out the event page on the Bestowed Essentials website or the Bestowed Essentials Facebook page. If you're in the Southern California area, I hope to see you at one of these events. And one more thing before we get into today's interview, I want to wish my grandma a very happy birthday. Today is her birthday. So I ask my listeners, everybody, to just send up good energy and love into the universe for my grandmother, who's one of my biggest inspirations. Grandma, I love you. Now for today's episode. And you have a podcast called Thrift Therapy. What is the overall premise of your podcast and how did you start it?
Well, let's see. I'm pretty old, so I'm 49. So I've done a lot of different things in my life, but I would say that the acorn version of that is I'm an artist, I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm an avid thrifter. And I've been thrifting since I was a teenager. I started my podcast last year in April or May, I believe, and I started it because as a therapist in private practice, I can be pretty isolated, meaning I go to work and I just see clients all day. I don't really work with anyone, so I don't have coworkers. And as you know, that's a primary way that we connect with people throughout our day in middle age for sure. So I just needed some social connection that was a little more fun. And because I thrift on the regular and I listen to podcasts on the regular, I thought, why not a thrifting podcast? So I hopped on the internet and looked up thrifting podcasts. And at the time, I could only find one. And so I thought, well, at least either no one will listen and it'll be fine, or other people will listen because there's a need. So I just literally started it in my car on the way home from a thrift store. Actually, it was on my way back to work. Sometimes I thrift between shifts.
That sounds like a great way to spend your breaks for sure.
Absolutely. Sometimes I just need to do a little self-care throughout the day so that I can create good boundaries between my work and my personal life.
Oh, I bet, especially with your job specifically. I'm sure it's really important to make sure that you're taking care of yourself so that you can, you know, the term, not pour from an empty cup, basically.
Oh, absolutely. That's a good phrase. I like that.
Now, how and when did you first start thrifting?
Well, I started when I was a teenager. I was in high school and we had moved from a small town to a bigger town, but it was about 45 miles from Houston. So I would drive into the city a lot. And my family was very conservative, this sort of culty religion where they had a lot of control on what people wore. So right about the same time that we moved to this town, my parents quit this cult and I suddenly had all this fashion freedom that I'd never had before. Like I could wear pants for the first time. I could cut my hair. I could wear makeup. But we didn't have any money. That's when I discovered thrifting and I first found resale vintage shops in Houston on Montrose Avenue. Are you familiar with Houston, Texas at all?
I've only passed through it once, so not very much at all.
Well, anybody who's familiar with Houston probably knows the area I'm talking about. It's at the time, it was a gay haven, and it's where all the gay clubs and cool vintage shops were, and there's a big festival there every year. And I just suddenly felt at home. Like I felt really comfortable there. So that was how I got started. I found, you know, like really chic vintage dresses for like $20, met really cool people who seemed more like me than any other people I'd ever met. And I was hooked from that day forward. And then I just eventually figured out, oh, they get this stuff from thrift stores. I can do that.
And what does thrifting as a lifestyle movement mean to you?
Well, when I started, it was in the 80s. So the first thing it meant to me was creativity. Like I could look how I wanted to look. I could feel how I wanted to feel. And it could sort of not just go into the mall and buy something and put it on and try to make a statement that way, like I could really play with fashion. And so that's what it first meant to me. Flash forward to the 90s, and it became a way to not only identify myself, but to think about global economy, because that was at the time where there was a lot of protest against the World Bank, to think about the haves and the have-nots, and to really think about, I guess, what's now called the fast fashion movement, which I was a part of at the time I worked in retail for a while. So it wasn't until the 90s that I began to think about it as a sustainability issue.
And you now use your thrifting skills to meet almost all of your family's consumer needs. How do you do that? And what are you not able to thrift?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, one of the things that I think any avid thrifter would tell you is that you have to go frequently. That's the main thing. It's not like you can just pop in with a list and be like, okay, we need pots, we need pans, we need curtains, and you're just going to find all that. That's retail, not secondhand goods. So you have to go often and you have to keep a running list, which is, you always have these things in your mind or, you know, even a visual representation of that. Like I use Pinterest as my running list of things that you're looking for. And then when you find it, you get it. You don't hem and haw about it too much because it's on your running list. So you have to be willing to go without that thing you need for a little bit to find the best deal and also the coolest thing because, like I said, it's a way for me to be creative as well. So, you have to be willing to have a little deprivation to get the extra rad stuff for like a dollar. Fortunately, my husband loves a deal and my son has grown up with that. So he's used to it. He thrifts on his own now as an 18-year-old. So that's his go-to as well. And then if he can't find it, he'll go to the store. So to, you know, like a retail store. So to address the second part of your question, when do we do retail? Well, it's when there's an urgent need. Like he's in theater, so sometimes he needs a white turtleneck, like yesterday. And that can be a tough call in Texas in the summer at a thrift store. So if we need something really specific, we'll hit up Amazon or some other, you know, retailer. And then if it's a high-end item, like a couch or a mattress, we will consider all of our options. And if it isn't an absolute necessity, like it's a replacement, I will put it on my list. I would say mattresses, I don't ever, I thrifted a couple of twin mattresses. But, you know, for a long-term mattress, I tend to buy those at retail new. I think that's it. I think something like mattresses and sheets are the only, towels. Mattresses, sheets, and towels are probably the only things that I feel like I have to buy new. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And with the items that you are thrifting, how do you clean them?
Well, you know, I have actually, I forgot about this, but I did get a mattress from the side of the road in my neighborhood. So I didn't thrift my house. Well, I don't know. I mean, house, it was secondhand, but I do have a really nice house. It's pretty big. It's pretty fabulous. That's my splurge, is my dwelling. So in my neighborhood, which is pretty good, there was a mattress on the side of the road that looked like brand new. And I just got that shit and stuck it in my garage. And I was like, I'm going to figure out how to clean this. And it was a really high-end mattress. So I just hopped on Pinterest and looked up all these different ways to clean a mattress. And I tried all of them. So I would say, get on the internet, get yourself a Pinterest board for hacks is what you want to look up, like H-A-C-K-S, cleaning hacks, cleaning DIY, and you're going to find just millions of options to try stuff. And a lot of the cleaning supplies you use, you'll already have in your house, like white vinegar, baking soda, salt, vodka. Well, we have vodka at my house. I don't know about you, but that's what I have. Let's see, what a club soda. So it's really, you know, taking items you already have in your house and repurposing them to make your own cleaners. And I still have that mattress in my guest room. And people that stay in there always ask me what kind of mattress it is. They like it.
Now, when you're at the thrift store, what do you look for in terms of knowing if an item is high quality and made to last and worth purchasing?
That is a skill that you have to learn. And because I have a background in fashion, I have that skill. I will do my best to give you a couple tips. How about that?
Perfect.
Okay. So one of the things that I learned when I worked in retail, and I think I took this skill with me to the vintage shops on Montrose as well, is that if you want to look luxurious, you need to pay attention to fabric and you need to pay attention to tailoring. And by tailoring, I don't necessarily mean fit. I mean the stitch work, the quality of the sewing that was put into the garment. And so the best way to get a skilled eye for that is to spend time in luxury retailers. So when I worked at the mall in my 20s, I spent a lot of time at Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, Bertolf Goodman, yeah, just all these really high-end retailers. And I very rarely could afford something there. It was a special treat. But I made myself very familiar with what's an Armani suit's worth $1,000? What makes a Chanel jacket so coveted? Why does this bag cost $500 and this one costs $40? You know, like you just have to be curious about those differences and you will figure it out. Like I feel pretty confident that I can discern whether something is a fake Louis Vuitton or a real Louis Vuitton at the thrift store. And if it's that good that it would be very hard for me to tell the difference, I'll usually get it anyway, because who cares at $6? But you want that quality, right? You want that really luxuriously well-made item. And since I believe there's a lot of gatekeeping in consumer goods, and what that means is that wealthy people get to have nice things and the rest of us get shitty things, you know, I work against that. I try to get nice things for shitty things prices.
So let's talk more about the psychology of thrifting and of shopping in general. Why does it give us such a good feeling to buy something?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I think economists have actually been trying to, capitalize on that for a long time. But it works.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of good economist studies about that specific euphoria. But it works very similarly to drug use. We get a dopamine rush from acquiring something we want. And this isn't just, you know, fashion items or furniture or suitcases or whatever it is. It's the thrill of the hunt and the thrill of the capture. So in a way, it's very evolutionary for us to be able to supply ourselves with what we need and want. Gives us such a good feeling that most of us are highly motivated to keep pursuing the things that we want and need.
That is a really interesting way of putting it that I'd never thought of before. I mean, I knew, you know, it gives us that dopamine rush, and I knew that it was similar to the way that drugs affect the brain, but I hadn't thought of it in terms of, you know, the hunting and catching and how it gives us that sort of evolutionary feeling.
Yeah, so, evolutionary psychology is a really fascinating take on a lot of our most basic brain functions. It's pretty interesting.
Maybe we aren't quite as evolved as we like to think that we are.
Absolutely not. In particular, when I think about emotions, that's where we're least evolved. And I think that is just quite simply because we've spent so much time societally focused on thinking processes or processes of reason and valuing those so much that we've sort of forgotten to evolve our emotion processing skills. So if you look at the maybe something outside of neurochemistry, what are the feelings that we get when we're thrifting or hunting or anything else that we're doing that makes us feel good? I think that we can look at maybe examples of when that goes wrong to understand that a little bit better, like hoarding or addiction. We can see that the feelings that we have that are associated with collecting things can sometimes be overwhelming, and we can start to need that feeling instead of just want it. And that's when we'll start to have some dysfunction around these kinds of activities.
So hoarding is on my list of things that I definitely want to get into in just a little bit, but I want to follow this side topic here for just a minute about managing our emotions. What advice do you have for that? How do we evolve in that manner, especially like as individuals, not even as a generational thing, but what can we do right now and throughout our lives to manage our emotions better?
This is something I work with in my daily life as a therapist is maybe helping us individually evolve our emotion processing skills. So I can just sort of take you through what I do at the thrift store, since, you know, we're talking about that too. So what I do is I allow myself full pleasure of going through the thrift store and just grabbing anything that brings up a positive response in myself, a feeling that I like. And I just throw it in my cart. So with no restrictions, and just enjoy that feeling. And then when I feel like I've gone to all the sections of the store that I want to go to, that's when I start to try to use some cognitive tools that I have to understand my feelings and make better choices. Now, this doesn't always work to 100% satisfaction, of course, but it does work better than just buying things impulsively. So for example, I'll take my giant cart full of stuff, you know, and this is what it looks like when I go thrifting. It's just this big mound of stuff. You know, people are always like, well, they're often like, oh my God, you're having a good shopping trip, or, ooh, are you going to get all that? You know, like they're just very curious about how much stuff I get. So I'm like, no, this is stage one. So then I go over to a mirror and I kind of start parsing things, and I'll hold the items. I will evaluate my response to them. And I think, what kind of feeling am I having to this object, and where's it coming from? These are the two most basic feelings questions that will make us smarter about our feelings. A lot of times we think the feeling we're having is coming from the object, which is just not true. Objects don't have any content. So the feeling is coming from you. And this explains why when I hold a copper tea kettle, I feel exhilarated. And when somebody else holds it, they feel annoyed or whatever they might feel, is because the pot doesn't have the feeling. You do. And even though that's something we sort of know, we don't acknowledge it enough in the moment. So I'll do that first. I'll go, what is my feeling and where is it coming from? So like if there's a bunch of vintage things that I found, like vintage dresses, I always get really good feeling about that. And I'll go, well, what am I feeling about this one versus this one? And I'll be like, well, I like this one. Why? Why do I like this one more? Where's that response coming from? Well, it makes me feel sexy, or it makes me feel like a grandma, and I like that feeling. So, you know, I just sort of understand a little bit better why this, why that, what's the feeling telling me about myself? And if you look at feelings as pieces of information about the self, they become more relevant and useful.
Yeah, this is reminding me of the Marie Kondo, you know, does this item spark joy? But getting way more in depth of, does it spark joy and why does it spark joy, is kind of what it sounds like.
Yes, that idea is very likely, I don't know if she knows that or not, but very likely based on emotion and cognitive psychology tools, is trying to understand why you're having the response you're having. And hers is just, what is the response? And it's very useful. A lot of people enjoy her method.
But how can we avoid unnecessary impulse purchases, those things that we see and we just have to have them, even though 10 seconds before we really didn't need them at all and we still don't, but the urge is so strong? How do you overcome that?
Well, I don't think you always have to overcome it. I think that we're seeking pleasure in life, and we need some kind of balance between practicality and pleasure. Pleasure gives us a lot of meaning. Practicality can too, but there needs to be some kind of balance there. So, you know, if you have some other kinds of boundaries, which is another psychology tool that we use to create a bridge between our emotion processing and our executive functioning, then you don't have to worry so much about overindulging. So I have boundaries when I go thrifting that help me manage the impulsivity I may experience.
And I do want to explore the topic of retail therapy more, as the term goes. When does retail therapy go from being a harmless hobby to being something that's unhealthy? And what can we do to help ourselves or a loved one who shops too much and perhaps for the wrong reasons?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to do if we're on the outside looking in is recognize our limits in helping that person. Personal distress like addiction or poor boundaries or depressed mood or any of these things that we may struggle with is not something that you can necessarily take responsibility for in someone else. And that question is a really good question for them. So I suggest just talking to them about how you feel about what you observe, you know, like saying, hey, you know, I noticed that I feel a little bit claustrophobic when I come over to your house these days. It seems like there's more and more stuff, and it makes me worry. So I really think just talking about your own response to somebody else's problem is a good start. And then just always ask them, is there anything I can do to help if they say they're in distress? You know, is there anything I can do to help you? Do you want less stuff? Do you need a helping hand getting rid of stuff? Do you need someone to go shopping with you and remind you that you're trying to buy less? I think that, you know, just being a compassionate observer for someone else's issue is a good way to go. Don't take too much of it on. Now, if it's you that's struggling, that's different. You have to take full responsibility. That's where you have to know if you're suffering because of your habits. Suffering is the single most important criteria for any mental health diagnosis. With mental health, it's not enough to be anxious. You have to be suffering from anxiety to have a generalized anxiety disorder label. A lot of people don't realize that. So if your buying doesn't cause you any distress, carry on. Now you have to look at the relational component. What if you live with the person and it's causing you distress that they're buying things? That's where it gets really tricky. And usually you're going to need to engage in some kind of therapy to find some boundaries that will work and manage that relationship in a more effective way for yourself. Does that make sense?
It does. And one of the hardest life lessons that's come up for me repeatedly, because I didn't fully learn it each time around, was that you can't help somebody who doesn't want or doesn't need to be helped, even if you feel a certain way.
Absolutely true. And that's another way that learning to process our individual emotions is so helpful, because a lot of times what's making us want to help others is our own feeling. And that's a valid feeling. It's a useful feeling. We just need to know it's coming from us.
To go back to hoarding, can you share some of the psychology behind hoarding and how a hoarding situation how and why a situation develops over the years?
Well, I'm not a hoarding expert, and it's a disorder I've only worked with a few times. It is one of the most difficult disorders I've encountered in terms of research on it is not as robust as it needs to be. In fact, the new diagnostic manual that came out a couple years ago only just recently segregated hoarding as a separate disorder. So now that it has a designation, perhaps the research in that area will continue to grow. And that would be really helpful, because we don't know as much as we need to know about what creates that chaotic relationship with objects. And there's certainly a lot of different ways to manifest hoarding, and there's a lot of good resources online if you know a hoarder, if you're a hoarder, if you question your own intake versus output, you know, it's like how much you take in versus how much you get rid of. That needs to be in balance. So when that's out of balance, that's when we can become in danger of developing a neurotic relationship with things. So the first thing that we do know is that there is a neurotic relationship with objects, and that means we have an emotional attachment to those things that often doesn't have a very clear relationship. So maybe you hoard newspapers because the day that your father died, he was on a newspaper route, but you don't really see the connection and nobody else sees the connection. Do you see what I'm saying there?
Yeah. Yeah. Hoarding has always been an interesting topic for me. And just our relationship with stuff. You know, I think I grew up with a parent that has never sought professional help, but I do think that she is a hoarder. And so my own relationship with things has been to go the complete opposite way and be an extreme minimalist and have as few belongings as possible, because I don't like being surrounded by things.
That's an interesting point too, Kelly, is that a lot of times a hoarder is in the exact opposite situation emotionally, like they've been deprived of something. And so they have a scarcity fear. So like if someone has five spatulas, it could be because they're afraid they're going to need those five spatulas at some point, and getting rid of them causes them to have panic. So it's there's very often a scarcity experience for the client who's hoarding, and that is an emotional trauma of some sort. Like perhaps their parent came in and cleaned out their room one day and threw away all their drawings, and now this person has a hard time letting go of anything. So there's sort of a subconscious emotional trauma for most of the hoarders that I've read about or worked with. That seems to be an important variable. And also, a lot of times there is a self-neglect or self-loathing aspect to that particular disorder, where the person thinks they deserve to live in some kind of particularly horrible way. So there are very deep psychological processes affected when someone has a hoarding problem. It's a little bit hard. It's each person is very likely to have a unique individual reason why they are afflicted with this problem.
So to help a hoarder, just going in and clearing out the stuff isn't getting to the root problem. It sounds like some therapy or counseling would also be necessary to help address the underlying issue. Is that right?
I believe so, because we're talking about some very in psychology, we look at something called depth psychology, which is about our subconscious processing. So these are issues of depth. So yes, but also I think if you're an observer, don't be afraid to join the hoarder in their space if they'll let you. And one of the primary experiences that I learned about working with this issue is the amount of shame, intense personal shame, that the hoarding experience causes or capitalizes on. It's hard to know which comes first. So try not to ever shame that person. They're already dealing with an intense amount of shame. And, you know, try to find your boundaries that allow you to see them in a positive light, even if the issue is difficult for you. That, and you know, don't be afraid to help. Just because there is a depth issue doesn't mean that cleaning it out isn't helpful.
And so let's talk about cleaning purges. How do we get rid of stuff sustainably, both for the environment and for ourselves, so that we don't just fill that empty space back up with stuff?
That's a really important, I think, focus. It's something that I personally use because I love stuff. My relationship with objects has always been as a creative. So when I see a beautiful object, I want to spend time with it. I'm more interested in thinking about who made it, why they made it, how they made it. And so there's this whole creative process that I get engaged with objects that inspire me. And because I have that propensity, and I have anxiety, and my mom and her mom are collectors of objects and also have anxiety, one of the things I worry about is being owned by my stuff. I don't want that. I'm the owner of the stuff. So that's priority number one, is make sure your stuff doesn't own you.
Oh, that is a really good way of putting it.
It's just stuff. All the meaning is happening internally. So that's a very critical understanding and awareness. For me, I do regular exercises to remind myself of that. There's been two times in my adult life where I have gotten rid of completely everything I own and started over, with the exception of what fit in my car. I feel like that allows me to let go.
And you said you've done that twice. So after the first time, mm-hmm. you built everything back up to the point where you felt like you had to get rid of it all again. How are you working with that the second time to not reach that point where you have to purge everything?
Well, I didn't feel like I had to. I felt like I wanted to. I felt like I wanted to let go. Because I'm a collector, the stuff that I tend to get is stuff people want. So I tend to think of it as an exercise in release and letting go and maybe sharing, right? So I have a lot of vintage stuff. I collect vintage things. So both times I just opened my house up, let people walk through and make me an offer on anything they wanted. And each time they did that to something I really loved, I had to go through a psychological process to transfer how I felt about that object to myself and release the object and let them make their own meaning of it. And that is good for me and it's good for them. So I try not to create waste. It's more like I'm letting go of this 1920s dress or this 1960s globe lamp or, you know, something that I know is going to get rehomed. And I enjoy that because it makes me feel like I am part of something, but I am doing my work as a person to make sure that I understand I'm the author of all my own meaning and that I can survive if something happens to my world.
My last question for you, what is your favorite thing that you've ever thrifted and how much did you get it for?
That is a really tough question for any thrifter. It's kind of like asking, what's your favorite movie? You know, it's like, today my favorite movie is...
How about the most unique thing that you've ever thrifted?
Oh, okay. That's easier. Well, I can only think in thrift probably back since moving into this particular house because I purge regularly. I forgot to say the other main boundary that I use to keep my stuff in balance is I have a limited amount of space and when it's full, things have to go. If I can't let go of something, I can't get something. So one of the things that I do now that there's social media is I rehome on Instagram. On my Thrift Therapy Pod page, I will just, you know, do like closet cleanouts and get rid of stuff. And that way I'm rehoming things. So when I think about that, I rehome so many fabulous things. Maybe I should think about one that I still have. Yeah. Okay. So I got this amazing, beautiful gold. Oh, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a Lurex lace dress that's like 1960s does 1920s. And it zips up the back and it's got these gorgeous dolman sleeves. And it's such an unusual piece. And I was throwing a 1920s themed party and I went to the thrift store a couple years ago to find something for that. And I was digging in the section. At the time, I was plus size, so it can be really, really hard to find plus size thrift. And just stuffed way down in the rack, like, I was like, what's that? And I just sort of pulled it out, and then I almost died of excitement. It was the best thing. I was like, this is freaking cool. I really hope it fits. So I threw it in my cart with like 500 things in it. And when I went over to the mirror to try it on, I mean, it looks so good that I was like, okay, this isn't even just a costume for this party. Like, this is a keeper. I'm stoked. So I've worn it like three times to three different events. And it was $6.99 and it was half off. So it was $3. And I just feel like I just feel like I could be on Downton Abbey when I wear this. I feel amazing in it. So that's my favorite.
Do you have a picture of it?
I do. I think I have a picture.
I would love to put it in the show notes.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll send you a picture.
Awesome. It sounds like an adorable dress for sure. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, it's really cute. And I just have too many things to name what my best thrift find is. But one of the things I ask people on my show is, do you have a best or worst thrift story? Like, so many weird things happen when you're thrifting. I just love those stories. So That's a fun thing to think about.
What's your worst thrift story?
Oh my God, I have so many. But the weirdest one, for sure, like I still don't know what to do with this experience. I lived in this neighborhood in the town I live in now in San Antonio, Texas. And it's one of those eclectic neighborhoods where there's like really old historical homes that have been turned into fourplexes and, you know, kind of down by the community college, big trees. And then there'll be like a $2 million restored home and then a $500 a month apartment like next door to each other, you know, the places like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I live down there and it's a walkabout area of town. I mean, people are on foot, they're walking dogs, they're riding bikes, they're outdoors, they're having yard sales. So one Saturday I was doing my usual jaunt and this guy about two blocks over from my little fourplex was having a yard sale and it was all this mid-century stuff and there were some legit antiques from like the 18th century. I mean, like this stuff was badass and I was just on foot. So I was like, okay, I'm going to come back. I'm going to buy these chairs. So don't sell them. And we just started talking and he was drunk and he was hilarious. So we started drinking cocktails, started having a really good time. And then he was like, hey, do you want to come inside and see all my cool stuff? And I was like, hell yeah. Okay. 49-year-old me is a little upset at 25-year-old me. Like, girl, you could have gotten murdered. But whatever, I went. And oh my God, this, it was like Sotheby's up in there. And in fact, he pulled out a Sotheby's catalog and started showing me some of the stuff he had. And all I could think was, who did you rob? Because this apartment was shitty. It was like dust covered everything. Like there was mold, you know, I mean, it wasn't a nice place. And there was hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of, I mean, I don't even know. It was ridiculous. So I got a little scared and I kind of was like, all right, dude, I got to go get that money and I'll be back for my chairs. And so I skedaddled out of there, got the 20 bucks for the mid-century chairs, walked them one by one to my apartment because I didn't want to tell him where I lived. I was scared he would rob me. And then the next time I was walking, it looked like that apartment was empty. And I just had the weirdest vibes. I don't even know what was happening, but I've never forgotten that. And at the point we were drinking before I went inside, he gave me this artist palette. Like, you know, it's like a wooden thing you put your thumb in and you put paint on, like from a cartoon. And he told me it was from a famous painter. And I can't remember who it was. It wasn't anybody I knew. And then after I went in his house and saw what was in there, I totally believed him. And I wish I still had that thing. I have no idea what happened to it.
That just, none of that makes sense. I wonder what his story was. And just,
I know.
Oh my gosh.
Can you believe? I mean, that's crazy. I'm surprised I didn't get murdered. That's all. That's all I think now is like,
yeah, as soon as you said
shit was going on in there.
Yeah, you said you were drinking and then he invited you to come in. I was like, oh no, don't go in. It's like the scary movie when you're shouting at the screen, don't do it.
Totally. Whenever I tell that story, I'm shouting at my younger self in my head, like, girl, stop it.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, so that's definitely the weirdest one. I still don't even know what was happening there.
And that's a wrap. I'll be back next week with Sharon Karn of Sound Wellness to discuss how sound affects the body and the mind.
If you find value in the Hippie Haven podcast, please share it with someone you know who'd be interested. You can leave a review on iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using, and also consider buying me a virtual cup of coffee to keep me going. Each podcast episode takes around 6 hours to create, and episodes cost about $50 each out of my own pocket. These costs include file hosting, editing, transcription for people who need or prefer visual content, and my own time of researching, drafting, recording, proofing, and promoting. Visit buymeacoffee.com/Callie, that's C-A-L-L-E-E, to support the work I'm doing with a $4 cup of coffee. Thank you all from the bottom of my heart for spending this time with me, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.